What is up, guys? Welcome back to the Zach and Pat Show. I'm Zach.
Pat.
This is the show about manhood, fatherhood, entrepreneurship, and the mentality it takes to be successful at those things. And we'll probably sprinkle in some helpful real estate advice, too, because that's what Pat and I do. You know, guys, life can be tough. We can go through some things and struggle at times, but this is the show to let you know that you're not alone. So if you're someone out there going through any of these things, this is the show for you. Shout out to our friends at NeuroGum for keeping us energized and focused. NeuroGum is a chewing gum, as well as they've got some mints as well. It's got caffeine, L-theanine, and vitamins B6 and 12. Helps with memory and focus. I like to chew it really, you know, all the time. If I'm driving around showing houses or making phone calls to my clients or when I'm podcasting or before a workout or during jiu-jitsu, I'll just pop a piece. Just kind of gives me a little bit of a mental boost, kind of just gets me a little bit more focused. So get out there, try some NeuroGum.
Also, shout out to our people over at Captain Beard Co. So all things beards as well as body wash, and they've even created candles. So they use all natural ingredients for their products, and their balms, their beard balms, beard butters, and oils are amazing. They help keep a healthy beard, which in today's day and age, we're seeing more and more people grow those big beards. You know, hop on, check their stuff out, and if you use the promo code Zach and Pat, you'll get 10% off your purchases.
Awesome, guys. Now to introduce our great guest today. He is a husband, a father, a managing partner of Macadoodles, a 14-year professional hockey goaltender, the great and powerful Mike McKenna.
Great. It's the first time I've ever been referred to as great and powerful. I feel like you just pulled back the curtain like the Wizard of Oz, and you're going to find out I'm actually this diminutive old man with gray hair who's fooling everybody. So we'll try. Well, we're gonna act like it is great and powerful, and I'll run with that.
Well, hey, absolutely.
14-year professional hockey career is nothing to shake a stick at, man. So it's super impressive.
No, thank you. Yeah, and it's funny because like I never expected to go that long or even to have a pro career. And like Pat and I have talked about this before about pro sports, you just never know how long it'll last. And I just kind of kept getting good opportunities, and it was at that point the best form of income, the most fun I could have. So why not keep doing this? Right. Even though I thought all along I'd be transitioning into something else, I just delayed it by about 20 years.
No, dude, that's amazing. I mean, I'm sure a ton of people out there would have loved that opportunity, and I'm sure it's amazing. So I'm happy for you. And it's, but yeah, let's dive into, for the people who don't know you, Mike, let's give them a little origin story if you could.
Sure. Super fast. I'm a St. Louisan. Lived in Manchester my whole life. My family's from South County, Concord Village.
Oh, cool.
And Crestwood.
We're in your neighborhood, huh?
Yeah, really am. Honestly, like I'm thinking where my aunt and uncle were right down the road off Tesson here. Okay. You know, I'm like, I want to go back and see that house again. But I grew up and went to Parkway all along growing up and played hockey at Kirkwood. That's okay. And hockey's kind of nice where they just do it within districts. You know, if your zip code's one place, it guides you. So felt pretty fortunate that I was at Kirkwood, had a great experience there, great experience at Parkway schools, public schools. I thought they were great. Left home at 16 to play hockey.
Yeah, so I saw that in your questionnaire. I definitely want to see. So you just left home to, where'd you go?
Springfield, Illinois. Okay. And when you leave home for hockey, you're leaving for the team that you make.
Okay.
You're not leaving to go to the bustling metropolis of Springfield and go to the Lanphier High School. It doesn't matter. Like, you're going for hockey. So, you know, that was what down the road I got to. But yeah, normal St. Louis in life. I played baseball. I played tennis, raced go-karts. I mean, my dad was really, really involved in auto racing, road racing, SECA, and that was big for our family. My grandfather started Kirkwood hockey in 1968.
Oh, cool.
And was on one of the, I mean, really, he's one of the founding fathers of hockey in St. Louis in the 50s. They had to drive 2 hours to get to a rink that had boards, you know, and dad was on the first youth hockey team in 1961. And so there's a lot of lineage there for us with sports, and even grandpa playing minor league ball for the Browns organization. You know?
Was it your grandpa or your dad that raced?
Dad did.
Okay. Yeah. And that what he was racing, was it IndyCars?
Yeah, it's the easiest way to get people to identify with what he did. It was kind of, he raced what were called Super Vs or Formula Continental, which 1982-3 at the time was the equivalent to what today would be Indy Lights, which would be AAA ball, mm-hmm. which would be the American League in hockey. And he did it on the amateur side, did a couple of pro races, famously raced with Bruce Jenner, you know, Caitlyn Jenner. And that's like the running joke in the family is that dad slept with Bruce Jenner, you know, because they shared a motorhome. And you can always kind of get people in on the gag. But yeah, I mean, he did some 24-hour races, Trans Am, and you know, for a guy who did this stuff in racing. He also played D3 ball at Wash U.
Okay.
You know, and held the batting title or batting records at Viani when he played baseball there and hockey. So I thought that stuff was normal. I thought that like every family had like people who were really good at all these sports, and that just, I didn't realize until later kind of how unique that was and how lucky I was to be able to do all these things with my dad and grandpa and even my mom, who played. The moment Lindbergh got women's or girls sports, she played every sport.
Yeah.
Which, you know, again, was for in the 60s, like that was a big deal and pretty cool for her.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah. So athleticism runs in your family.
Well, you wouldn't guess it if you looked at me. I mean, I got scoliosis, flat feet, short shins. I mean, I run like a wounded gorilla, but
perfect makeup for a goalie.
That's exactly right. This body was made for one thing.
Yeah, one thing, stopping pucks.
That's it. It's not taking the
just
shirt
getting
off.
Getting in the way.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I was kind of flexible.
I feel like you have to be if you're a goalie, right?
It helps, yeah. For sure. You know, it helps you with avoiding injury more than it really does as you play, but I got stupid long arms somehow. Like,
yeah.
My arms are like 4 inches wider than my height, you know, my wingspan is. And so, yeah, when I kind of looked at it, it made sense that I was naturally good at goalie. I was always doing hand-eye stuff. So of all the athletic prowess I may have had, hand-eye was really the thing. Baseball, tennis, hockey, I always was throwing something against the wall as a kid.
Well, now, what's it like seeing your daughter become a goalie?
Oh, it's wicked. Like our 11-year-old last year became a goaltender, and she'd begrudgingly played 3 years as a skater before that.
Okay.
She wanted to be a goalie the whole time. We wanted her to have the experience of sport first and knowing this is what she wanted to do. And now to watch her and to kind of see myself through the lens of her, you know, and just, it's almost like watching myself at times and to see her discover the game. And something that I was passionate about and we can share is, it's pretty awesome, man. And she's done great. Like, proud of her as can be. And her, you know, even our youngest one now is.
You said the oldest is 11?
She's 11, yeah. Okay. Our youngest is 8. She kind of plays hockey. She more kind of floats around out there.
Does she like it?
I think she likes being on the ice.
Okay.
She likes being out with her friends.
Okay.
But she really loves gymnastics that she just started.
Okay.
So I think we can kind of see where this is going with her.
Yeah. Yeah. That way, at least you got one that wants to play hockey.
Well, and I don't care.
Yeah.
I just want him to be passionate about something.
Yeah.
And I'm really happy that it's sports in some way. I do think team sports are invaluable in life and what you learn.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if she gets a little bit of team sport, even if it's not anything high level and does gymnastics too, I think that really rounds out a person.
I agree. And I think there's benefits to individual sports too. You know, that's kind of the world I come from, wrestling and jiu-jitsu. Like, I think that you get something from both. I think there's benefits to both. Because, I mean, I think we need to know how to work as part of a team, but we also need to be, you know, strong individuals by ourselves too. So
you've got to find what motivates you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, for me, I was an only child, so a lot of it, my parents treated me like an adult when I was a kid, and I didn't realize that until later that it wasn't normal to not have seen Disney movies and, you know, all this stuff. I did it all on my own. And so I think that kind of lends itself to the individualism you were talking about, where there's a ton of value in that. Tennis was kind of like that. I'd go practice and hit balls off a backboard, you know, and do, in my eyes, have to find ways to motivate yourself and to also be able to self-evaluate. And in a team sport, you get that all the time from a coach.
Right? Well, I mean, with hockey, I mean, it's a team sport, but as a goalie, like, you're out there by yourself, really. I mean, yeah, you've got five guys on the ice in front of you, and those five are working together as a unit to score goals. But as a goalie, I mean, you're out there on your own. Like, that's your, like, I mean, that's like the individual, like for baseball, you know, as a pitcher, like, you're the individual, you're having to control that game, you're controlling the pace, you're controlling all that stuff. And so there's that individual aspect within baseball. And I would assume that being a goalie is probably similar to that.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, goalie in hockey is a sport within a sport. It's completely different. It's also why it's ridiculous when they want people to go train like a player when you're a goalie. The biomechanically, it's just so different. But to your point, though, Pat, I think that hockey goalies, baseball pitchers, football quarterbacks, like, we all live in the same house but different rooms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have a very specialized position within a team sport, kickers in football, you know, but the pressure's not as much. I mean, unless you're Ray Finkel, you're worried about the laces being in. But
die, Dan, die.
Oh, man. I got to tell you, I have a Dolphins Finkel shirtsy with five on the back. And I'm telling you, every time I wear that sucker to Costco, somebody yells out, laces out. You know? It makes my day. It's the best, man. But
Finkel is Einhorn. Einhorn is Finkel. Yeah.
Somebody the other day goes, I thought you were Einhorn. I go, no, I'm Ray. but every sport that has team tends to have
that one individual aspect.
Yeah,
of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And
that makes sense.
It's fun to bounce it off one another, you know, like when I've talked to pitchers or quarterbacks and what that's like, you know, and even if I'm finding out right now, I mean, I'm working with Brady Cook and something we're doing away from sports, and Brady Cook, the Mizzou quarterback. And just in those brief instances, finding out, like, how do you see the field? Is it similar to how I would see the rink?
Mm-hmm.
I'm focused on the ball, you're focused on the receiver, but peripheral, what do we see? Like, that fascinates me how much these sports kind of cross-pollinate like that.
Oh, absolutely, because as a goalie, you got to see how the play is forming in front of you. Same thing as a quarterback. You're having to read the defense and see how they're moving and know your guys' routes. And, quarterbacks, it's amazing everything that they have to know and the timings on each individual route and all the things. I mean, that's a tough position.
They're processing much information in real time.
Oh, it's insane.
The best decision makers for her.
Yeah, I mean, you got to know what 10 other guys are doing. And also, you need to know what you're doing, too.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I mean, Pat, as a pitcher, is it kind of similar? I mean, obviously, you're focused on the batter, but when you've got runners on the base, is it the same that you have to have that awareness, or are you getting support from your catcher and other players?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the thing is you rely on your guys behind you to keep runners close. At first, obviously, your first baseman's going to be holding runners on. At second base, you've got your middle infielders that are working back and forth, and you have to be able to read those. If you see a guy, you've got timing plays and stuff like that for pickoffs. But ultimately, once a guy's on base, you have to think about, mixing up your timing, because if I come set and I'm doing one Mississippi, two Mississippi throw, they're going to pick up on that. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I come set, they're going to count one Mississippi, two Mississippi, and take off. And my catcher is not going to have a chance. So, those are little things you got to pay attention to when guys are on base. But also, when nobody's on base, really, you're just focusing on strengths and weaknesses of that pitcher. Now, obviously, you want to try and pitch their strengths, but if your weaknesses don't line up with that and your weaknesses are their strength, like where it lines up with their strengths, like you're wanting to pitch to your strengths versus pitch to their weaknesses. Mm-hmm. So, there's a lot of nuances to it. And then, you've faced guys multiple times. Now it's like, hey, they've seen everything that I've thrown. They know how I'm going to attack them. Like it can be a chess game. Like, mm-hmm. I just faced this guy last time. He knows that I've gotten him out a couple times on sinkers away. Well, let me try and bust something in on him with like a cutter or a fastball in, even though that might not be my strength, but at least it's something to show him something different that I can do something. So there's chess matches in that, but it's not like the catcher has to see more of what's going on in that aspect than I do. And he's relaying things to me at the same time. So I would say the catcher would have more of that surveying the field and things like you would on mm-hmm. the ice, or a quarterback has to do under center. So
yeah. Everything's in front of us.
Right. Exactly.
It's also why I didn't want to play catcher.
Yeah.
I did enough in hockey. I didn't want to play catcher, and they kept putting me there in baseball.
It makes sense.
I just wanted to shag balls in the outfield, man. That's all I wanted to do.
No, you put all those pads on and stand in front of the thing coming at you really fast.
It was enough. I'd had enough.
Well, for those that don't know, so hockey is way different the way you progress through than most sports. I mean, most sports, you're following your age. Mm-hmm. You go from, playing in elementary school to middle school to high school, then on to college, then if you're fortunate on to pro ball, or you might make the jump from high school to pro ball. But with hockey, it's way different. I mean, you said you left home at 16. Like, what does the journey look like for an advanced level hockey player?
Yeah. And you know what's funny is there really isn't a clear cut path. Like, there's so many ways to make it to at least, let's say, college hockey. Okay.
What?
You know, and that's the thing. You just still have to choose between college hockey and playing what's
overseas,
called major junior, which is in Canada. Okay. And there's some teams in the United States, but that tier one junior hockey even hockey is 16 to 20 years old.
Okay.
And this is age group. I mean, like you do. You played with your peers until you're 16, and all of a sudden, I made a junior team at 16 as a goalie, and there were three of us in the nation playing at that level, and I'm playing like 20-year-old.
Okay. Yeah, that's a big difference.
Well, that's the thing. There's 20-year-olds.
High school to a kid that's halfway through college, you know?
Right.
And there's 20-year-olds are trying to get college scholarships, right?
Exactly.
So you're seeing, like, hockey players are typically a little bit older when they're heading into college.
Yeah, that's very true. That if you look at college teams for NCAA Division I hockey, they are older. They're, you know, you're looking, a lot of kids are between 19 and 23, 4. And even in the last couple of years when they added, now you could, because of COVID, there was a fifth year added. Now there's transfer portals. Like, it's kind of the Wild West. It used to be very clear cut. You went to a school for 4 years.
I'm not a fan of this transfer portal and NIL money and things like that, but that's a whole nother thing.
I think the transfer portal takes away from making an initial good decision and sticking with what you did.
It takes away from building those legacy programs. Like, you know, there's no loyalty.
You're always looking for something. I don't like that aspect. But so you leave it. You know, I left at 16. That's abnormal. It's starting to become more normal. People are even at like 14 with their kids now. There's so much FOMO amongst parents, and it's insanity what they're spending, doing. They're just afraid their kid won't get the best chance. And so you can, if you go to junior hockey, you know, you can play until 20 years old. It's kind of typical. A lot of kids will end up playing junior by like 18, 19. And it's almost like going to junior college. Like, a lot of them will go, they'll take a couple college courses at a community college and play junior. And then go to college. And so I'm going to even leave out like going to Canada out of this conversation, and just focus on U.S. college, because that's kind of what you're towards. And U.S. college hockey now, NCAA, has become an amazing path to the NHL. Way more people are gravitating to it. And you get top prospects coming at 18 years old. Thing is, they only last a year or two. And then they go to the pro hockey.
Yeah, so how's that draft work? So like for Major League Baseball, you have to either be a junior or have turned 21 before the draft. So, I mean, very rarely, like, you're not seeing fresh, unless you're going into junior college. Mm-hmm. If you're going to a four-year university, you have to be there until you're 21 for the draft or a junior, whichever comes first.
So it used to be that 18 years old was everybody except college players. Like, when I was drafted in 2002, I was 19 years old. The reason being was I went to college. You had to have been 19. 1 year in college before you were eligible to be drafted. And then that changed a couple years later, and now it's just 18. 18 is your draft year. But you don't have to opt into a draft. You don't lose your eligibility if you're drafted.
That's how baseball is.
Yeah, so like, I mean, I was drafted after the freshman year by the Nashville Predators, and I went to their rookie and development camps. You know, I drove there. I had to pay the way for this. They couldn't pay for stuff.
Oh, really? So you get drafted and then you still have to, like...
Yeah, and
if you accept money, then you lose your amateur status with NCAA.
Yeah.
Okay.
But so, I mean, but there's ways to make this work. Like, you're not, and like, you're coming in and spending $1,000 on hotels. Like, the hotel's covered and stuff. Like, it works. But, yeah, I was drafted in 3 years. I didn't sign with Nashville. I wasn't a hot prospect. I was a sixth round pick. Hockey has seven rounds. It was nine back then. And then even after I finished school, I didn't end up signing with Nashville. So I was a free agent.
So how long do they hold the rights to you for?
4 years.
Or
if you're in college, they hold it through August after your senior. Okay. So, and I came out, it was 2005, and we'd just come off a lockout year for hockey. So like, revenues were in the gutter. The hockey was on OLN. Which turned into Versus, which turned into NBC, but it was on OLN, and like, nobody was spending money. And so Nashville was running really lean. They had four goalies that they had under contract, and that was it. Now, typically, NHL teams have for sure five goalies, probably six under contract at any time. And the Predators decided to sign a guy named Pekka Rene instead of me. This guy's got about...
heard of him.
He's probably got, I don't know, 55 sheets in the bank more than I do. So it worked out. Honestly, it worked out for him. And really for me, though, it wasn't... It might have given me a leg up to have signed with them and started an organization. But I mean, I think ultimately you get what you can out of a sport as long as you perform at a certain level. And I probably topped out at what I was capable of. And I was being a number three bully. It was call up, a send down guy, a fill in. That's what it was.
Don't sell yourself short. You're also, you hold the record for most wins by an American born goalie, correct?
In the American Hockey League, which is AAA level. Yeah. I of all the things in that league I'm proud of, or really in my career,
that's incredible.
I mean, dude, I got an American flag on my arm. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm, especially in hockey, like, you are, when I was growing up, man, you were an underdog if you were an American. And if you were from St. Louis,
yeah, you're,
who is this peasant? Right. You know? Yeah, and it's, sure. So I think our city, though, it was always very much like us against them, underdog mentality. Like, when Cam Jansen was the first guy from St. Louis to make it, we were all just so excited as a city, as a hockey community. It's like, somebody finally did it.
Yeah.
And now look.
Two dozen plus.
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, shit, we had that one year where there was 7 first-round picks out of St. Louis.
They had...
was it the Kachuk?
I think it was 5 in the first round and 7 in the first 2 or something.
Something
it was like
that, yeah.
It was crazy. And it was one of the Kachuk brothers, Luke Cunnan, Trent Frederick.
Keller.
Keller was on that team as well. Joseph Wall, the Leafs goalie now, he was like early third or late second. So like, it was unbelievable that happened. And it just kind of knocked the door down. There's not real glass ceiling anymore. You're seeing players from Florida, Texas, California, and St. Louis is well-regarded now in hockey.
Well, and I think it helps, too, that, like, St. Louis community as a whole, like, the players come here and play for the Blues, and then they don't want to leave. And so you got kids, like, that the kids of NHL players that are wanting to stay around here, and that's just increasing the talent because you've got these NHL players that are there helping coach, being around the game, and all that stuff. I just think that just speaks to the community of St. Louis and how people come here and don't want to leave.
Yeah, and it's – people will look at the alumni of the Blues as – the catalyst for why youth hockey has done so well. And while that is completely true, the real catalyst for it is what you mentioned. It's this community. The alumni want to live here. You guys, you're in real estate, you know, and like, this is still one of the best markets compared to other places.
Absolutely.
You think somebody who played in Anaheim wants to stay there unless they've been a superstar with all the money in the world. If you're a mid-level NHL player, if you're a lower level NHL player, what you can get for your money in this city and raise your kid and quality of life and 4 seasons and a built-in alumni network. It's and by the way, people, they might call the Midwest flyover. You're close to both coasts. You're close to Canada. You're I love living in the Midwest,
yeah,
man.
Me too, man.
I can get wherever I need to. So I think it really plays into it, man.
Yeah.
Well,
and then so also part of that being in and playing professional hockey, you were part of the Players Association or how, like, it's. Okay, we didn't have that in baseball.
We've had that talk before.
there's none of that with minor league baseball.
And it may
start to come around, I think, to it. But
yeah, you know, I know they finally won a lawsuit against MLB to get some repatriation for the players.
Got that check last year.
That's good. And I'll make sure I hook you up with my buddy Garrett, who helped lead that up for Garrett Broheis. But, you know, hockey was really fortunate that it did unionize at the minor league level, late 60s. And so there's actually the National Hockey League Players Association, it's the Professional Hockey Players Association, and the PHPA covers the minor leagues, covers AAA, AA level, and NHLPA covers NHL players. Well, you know, what that really did was give players a chance to make a good living in minor league hockey. And I mean, there's guys that are knocking down 300, 350, 400K in the minors, right?
Really?
Yeah, there's nothing like that in baseball.
No, that's not everybody, mind you. Right. And, you know, but league minimum now is up to like 55, 60 grand.
Okay.
And for the most part, everybody makes more than that anyway. Anybody who's on an NHL entry level contracts probably making close to 175 a year. That includes their bonus. So bonus structure is different, right? Baseball, big ass bonuses, right?
I hate it.
Hockey's different with the bonus structure, but you can make a good living. But you gotta, there's veteran rules too, though. So it's hard, but yeah, I did, I was on exec board in the minor leagues for pretty much my whole career. I was chairman of exec board for almost a decade doing it. Just learned a ton of business stuff, how to negotiate collective bargaining agreements, contracts, sitting face to face like we are with billionaire owners of teams and GMs and trying to eke out an extra $50 a year in healthcare for guys.
Yeah. Well, you said, so how does the bonus structure work with NHL? I have no idea. Or with hockey in general, I guess.
So entry-level contracts are, they're very much capped at what you can make on an entry level. A 3-year entry-level contract is your max, and then you have restricted free agency for another, basically by the time a player is 27 or 8 is when they would hit free agency. So, but that first initial contract, the first 3 years, they're kind of capped out. There is bonus structure that can be built in. The most a rookie can make in the NHL, without having numbers in front of me, is like 1.1 or 2 with bonuses. For the most part, though, the rookie salary is 750 or 8 right now, something like that. But they do make bonus on top of that, which is spread out over those years, even if they're playing in the minors. So even if they're in the minors, they're making, you know, like 80 grand and then $100,000 bonus, whatever. It's kind of in that structure. I'm throwing ballpark stuff.
So, but the signing bonuses aren't huge.
No, and that changed. I talked about a lockout in 2004-05. It really changed before that. Like if you were a high prospect for a second rounder, your signing bonus could be $1 million before that, which that was tangible, right? They really dialed that back coming out of the next lockout, that the max your contract's going to be worth those first 3 years is, especially if you're playing in the minors, was kind of like closer to 500, 600. But if you ended up in the NHL, then you could make 3-4 million off those. It's that second contract that's, it used to be the second contract was a bridge deal. 2-3 years, mid-level, prove it to us. Now they've gotten smart with analytics, and they're taking a little bit of a gamble, teams are, and they're willing to take those second contracts for big money for long-term, hoping that you sign a guy for 8 years at $6 million for $48 million total. You're hoping that player is really worth $8 million for the last four, if the fancy stats are projecting to it. So hockey's finally starting to accept what they've done in baseball and other sports, trying to pay a little bit ahead as opposed to being behind the curve for it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. I am not a fan of the signing bonus structure that Major League Baseball has. I mean, shoot, before too long, I mean, first-round draft picks, first overall picks can get paid $10 million. Mm-hmm. And I mean, when you look at it, in the percentages of people that make it to the big leagues is very, very slim. And, you know, even those high round picks. So like, I remember playing with guys that were signing for millions of dollars and they'd get that bonus and they just, I mean, like, yeah, I got my money. That's all they really wanted. They didn't give a shit if they made it to the big leagues or not. I always thought like, yeah, you know what? Hey, we'll give you you want a $2 million bonus? We'll give you a $2 million bonus, but you have to hit, like, we're going to give you this up front for signing your name, but then as you progress through the minor leagues, we'll bonus you out even more that way. So keep these guys wanting to improve and get better instead of throwing a shit ton of money at them right off the get. Now, you've got certain guys like Paul Skeens and Dylan Cruz. Like, those guys were the 1 and 2 picks in the draft back in 2023, and they're both in the big leagues. And shoot, Paul Skeens is up for being Rookie of the Year. Like, yeah. That guy got $9 million for signing. That was probably a good investment. But at the same time, like, there's a way that could have been structured out. Like, hey, you know what? We're going to do this. You get it here, we're going to give you this much. Mm-hmm. You get this and make it to the big leagues, then you'll get the rest of that bonus. But they don't do it that way. And then they pay minor league baseball players. I mean, when I played, it was shit. Like, the most I ever made playing baseball was $1,800 a month. And I only got
it hurts my soul to hear that. And you're playing professional baseball.
Yeah.
And living 5-6 deep in a place.
Yeah. And you're only paid for the months that you're paying. Like, you don't even get paid for spring training. You didn't get paid. No, there's no payment in the off season. So, like, I mean, I was working 3 jobs in the off season and I had to make sure that I had an extra $7,000 to $10,000 saved up heading into spring training just so I could afford to live and play professional baseball. Now, a lot of changes have gone into place over the last few years, and the players are getting paid more, but it's still not very much. Right. And that's the thing, too, is, like, I had to pay for my apartment and where I live. And like you said, we'd have five guys in a 2-bedroom apartment. I can't tell you, I slept on blow-up mattresses in the kitchen. And we'd figure out hacks. Hey, Walmart has a great return policy.
30 days.
Oh, no, it's
90 days
no,
now?
No, like, we would go... And we would buy a TV for spring training, and then we would return it right before we left. And then we would go buy another TV when we got to where we were living. And then at the end of the season, we would return it.
We used to do this in hockey, too.
I mean, and so, like, that's the thing. And, like, you know, you'd work the system. So, like, for me, like you said, being in the center of the country, it's pretty easy to get places and fairly cheap. So a one-way ticket on Southwest to Arizona was, like, $99. So I would tell the Reds that I was driving, because then they would send me a check for like $1,000 to drive from St. Louis to Arizona. And I would just take that, pay for my one-way ticket, use the rest to pay for my apartment for the rest of spring training, and then get bank on the money like they gave us, like per diem,
yeah,
for living outside. So like you found ways to work the system, and it sucked. It was kind of like, I mean, I was happy that I got promoted to double A, but at the same time, I'm like, fuck, I was going to get a check to drive home from California to St. Louis versus a check from Florida to St. Louis. Now I'm like, well, shit, now my check alone is just going to cover my plane ticket versus having some extra money coming home.
That's crazy to think that it's like that when it could be structured so much more efficiently. Well, it's also let the players develop. Like, you want your players to become to play in Major League Baseball, but you don't want to give them enough money to live and to train and be professional baseball players.
I fucking hated the offseason. It was the fucking worst, because this is what my day looked like. I would wake up at about 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, get breakfast, meet my buddy who also played and we'd go to the gym. We'd get our workout in. From there, we would go to the facilities that we trained at and play catch, and I would throw him BP and things like that, and we'd do our drills. And we would do that until about 1 o'clock. And then from there, I would either have pitching lessons or I was coaching or something. And then once I got done with that, I worked at Steinberg Ice Rink. Yeah, I was a rink.
Chasing kids around out there.
Yeah. Stopping proposals.
Yeah, I said on an earlier episode where I think I pissed more people off because I broke up and interrupted so many proposals. It's amazing how many people want to propose there, but like, hey, give me a heads up.
Oh, God, so I'm not,
they do it right before the, yeah, they do it right
at
before
Kirkwood.
The, yeah.
between the rinks, you know, between them cleaning the ice, they drop to a knee and propose, or they'd be like hanging out on the ice. I'm like, guys, we got to get off. Dude, I'm trying to propose here. I'm like, fuck, give me a heads up.
Do it when everybody else is out here. Yeah. Make it festive.
Yeah,
the ice isn't yours, man. We got to clean it. At least I did it during a public session. Yeah. You know? So. I got the crease and I told the rink manager, hey, just clear me off a section.
Well, you got to like let them know. Like, right. That's, I feel like that's the key part. Well,
yeah, okay, I'm not proud of having to interrupt these things, but like, oh,
it's a job.
It's my job.
You got to let someone know.
So there was that. And then what else did I do? Less pitching lessons. I mean, like I was working, you know, 60 hours a week, like Monday through Sunday, and then trying to train on top of it. Like, I fucking hated the off seasons. It was miserable.
What do you think about people that think, that say, well, you're playing a kid's game?
Oh, fuck those guys.
The people that say that have never lived
never been there.
Yeah, it's okay to try
to play a game.
Yeah.
And guess what?
Also not getting paid because you're not good enough to do what we're doing. People that'll do that all the time. Yeah, like,
for sure.
Oh, you were just a third goal. But who are you to talk in media? You would give your left nut to have had my career if you want to shit on my career.
Well, and here's the thing, too, is like at any second, that can end.
Yeah.
Just because you're getting paid to play, especially with like where I was at and where I got drafted, like if I wasn't performing, I was gone. Like I had to prove every time I was out there on the mound, I had to prove like I didn't have some leeway like some of these first round picks.
They weren't guaranteed contracts.
No. And so at any time they could just be like, all right, you're done. And like, that's the thing. Yeah. So like baseball is a kid's game, but once you get to that level, it's not a fucking kid's game anymore.
It's business, man.
There's business. There's all sorts of things that are tied to it. And So I'm just like, people would say that. I'm like, oh, obviously you've never played a sport before, or at least at a high level.
High level. Yeah. Yeah. You know, you hear this all the time. People that, especially in hockey, well, I blew out my knee and it ruined my career.
Yeah.
Oh, I hear
shut
all the time.
Like, shut up. Shut up. You quit.
You know how many people in this world blew out their knee? Right. Like, I hear that all the time. Well, I had some offers, but I blew my knee out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I signed to go to a school, but, I blew my elbow out or my shoulder out that year. I'm like,
yeah, I was going to play in college, but, you know, I hurt my knee my junior year, and then I just decided not to play my senior year. It's like, well, no, you fucking quit, dude.
We've heard that
like,
so many times. And it's so hard to not be a dick about it. You know, like, and just. You want to look at these people and go, you are a poser and you don't know what you're talking about. And honestly, in their heart of hearts, they probably know they weren't good enough and that injury was a good enough excuse, or they were just delusional to what processes were like. I had colleges talking to me. Oh, yeah, who? Oh, Mizzou was talking to me about hockey. That's club hockey, dude. Right. Like, this is a different planet, man.
Or they're
like,
trying to fluff it up to make them seem better,
Don't try
in
to church it up, dirt.
Right. Well, like, and that's the thing.
Be honest. You know?
Well, and that's the thing is, like, we just had Rocky Alberidi on here. I don't know if you know that. He owns New Age Health and Wellness, and he's one of the coaches at Lindenwood, coaches the club team at Lindenwood. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing he was telling us. He was just like, yeah, there's a big difference between the D1 club D1 team at Lindenwood versus the club team. And
huge,
and that's the thing. Like, yeah, people are like, oh yeah, I'm getting, I'm like, they don't give offers for club hockey. Like, I know that that school doesn't have a Division One team.
You know what's crazy? They're giving scholarships to kids to play club hockey at colleges now.
Are they really?
They're funneling it through by saying it's financial aid.
Okay.
And it is, but like, it's become FOMO with even club hockey now. You can't get a scholarship for D3 hockey. There's no scholarships in D3 hockey.
And there's no scholarships whatsoever by the NCAA for D3.
No.
In any sport.
But this ACHA Division One hockey is giving scholarships to kids. And I don't agree with this at all, because I think they represent themselves as Division One. Because it's Division One ACHA. They're fooling people. I had people for years like, isn't Lindenwood D1? Well, they are now. They were not for years, and they were recruiting and giving scholarships and blowing all these other teams out of the water. And it's like, yeah, of course you're going to win if you're doing that. There's no rules against it.
Yeah, they've got because academic endowments. Because I remember I was getting recruited by Bradley, and like they gave me so much of a baseball scholarship, but they're like, because of where your essay or your ACT score and your great GPA is, we can give you an academic endowment that would basically take my scholarship from being 75% up to like 97%.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, it's pretty nice, but I'm like, I'm going to college for baseball, not for school. So I'm probably going to lose that academic endowment.
Thing is, I don't hold it against any player or coach that takes advantage of that. If you're playing, if you're playing club hockey and you're getting scholarship,
exactly. And
coaches, I think at the regulation level, it's kind of disingenuous. That's what I disagree with. So I always want to make sure I make that clear.
Right, because you're kind of taken away from the people that are actually playing at the D1 level. Yeah. It's like you're cheapening
it. It really can. And that's when you've performed at that level, you know how hard it is to get there. It's kind of it's almost like a stolen valor thing in some ways, you know, or somebody who overrepresents what they've done in a sport. Ask me, man. I was a third goal, you know, like. I was no superstar, right? Like, you just say what you did.
Right. And, I mean, that's the same. Like, I it's funny because, like, I'm part of this major, like, this professional baseball players group on Facebook, and they are constantly, like, booting people out that played independent ball. Like, it's still professional baseball. Shit, I played independent ball for a year after I got released from the Reds. Like, that's still professional baseball, and I'll be honest, that's more competitive and in my mind, better baseball than some minor league baseball, because you're actually playing to win. Minor league baseball, you're individual. You're just trying to pad your own stats to move up to make that 25-man roster on the big league. So, like, in independent ball, you're actually playing to win. I mean, I can't, like, the team that I played on, I mean, we carry a 25-man roster. I think at one point, like, we counted that one, like, there was, like, 50 guys that had funneled through our 25-man roster in a season. Like, they burn through guys. If you're not performing, see it, boom, gone. And so, you know, these guys that played affiliate ball with a major league team are bashing on these independent guys. And I'm like, that's fucking bullshit. Like, that's still professional baseball. Now you got the guys that play they call it men's league baseball, like, that are trying to pass it off. Like, oh yeah. I'm like, nah, no.
That's my favorite. Like, did you play semi-pro?
Yeah.
Or if you're not in the NHL, it's not pro. It's like, there actually isn't semi-pro in hockey.
No,
like, you're either a pro or not. Like, you either get paid or you don't. Right. So. Yeah, we could rap forever on this stuff, but it's really cool when you sit down like this, because Zach, you can see how much similarity between sports.
Yeah, I'm seeing it for sure.
Oh, man. Yeah. We could go on and on.
No, I didn't play any sort of professional sports here. So.
Well, and I mean, he's into jiu-jitsu, and we just recently had the largest payout jiu-jitsu tournament in its history.
Yeah,
$1 million to the winner, which...
Yeah, I mean, Just put things in perspective, the pinnacle, like our Olympics for jiu-jitsu, it happens every 2 years. It's called ADCC. And the winner of that tournament gets $10,000. So, like, you could train all fucking year. And yeah, so you might get some sponsorships and some other things that come along with that. But you got to also, you have to earn those, too. I mean, they're not just giving those out to, you have to be someone who's going to put eyeballs on them, you know? So, but this tournament that they just did, it was called the Craig Jones Invitational. So the guy that put it on, he had gotten second place in that big tournament that I was talking about, ADCC. He'd gotten second twice, and he got $3 million essentially donated to him from an anonymous donor. And he was trying to petition, say, like, hey, you know, I know you guys are making a ton of money on this, like, you know, the athletes should be paid more. And so he's like, well, if you don't like the way we're doing it, do your own tournament. And so he said, I'm going to do just that. And he ended up getting someone to donate $3 million, and he was going to do essentially two weight classes and basically try to recruit the 16 best guys in the world in basically two different weight classes, above 80 kilograms and below 80 kilograms. And $1 million goes to the winner, and everybody that gets chosen to come gets $10,001. And then he put it on the exact same day as this other tournament. So the athletes had to then, so like there was a lot of these athletes that were going to go to this other one, and it's like, okay, it's basically, do you want the prestige or do you want the money? And there was a ton of athletes that dropped out of ADCC and did his, because it's like, I get just to show up, I get the kind of money that I would get if I win. But I've also got a chance to, if I win four matches, I get $1 million.
No, it shows how much you need leadership for these things. If you're going to do a rival league or a rival tournament or anything, you better know what you're doing, or you better have the funding to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for sure.
Because you've seen this in a couple different sports. Auto racing was one. IndyCar racing fell off the map in 1995 when they split. 1994. Okay. They split, and it didn't work. Now, there were millions and millions and millions of dollars on the line in different series and things. Or something like what you just described, that essentially when your payouts and your purses are only in tens of millions, maybe tens of millions, it's small.
Yeah.
There's room for growth there, because there's a desire for that sport. It hasn't been led properly from everything you just told me. You got one greedy group that's doing this and not paying it out. So I know rodeo was like that at some point, and I can't remember their exact path, but it was, why on earth are we doing this and not getting paid until they kind of banded together to make something better? And I think that was origin of PBR, I want to say. I don't know that to a T, but it either takes the athletes organizing and finally saying, no, we're not doing this anymore. Right. Or you get somebody that with enough business foresight to realize, if you pay the athletes the right portion of what they deserve, that they'll perform for you and become loyal to you, you can create something bigger and better.
Right, because without the athletes, it's nothing.
It is. You're the show, man.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and what's crazy about it is, I mean, yeah, they did it the same day, but what was I going to say? Train of thought. Sorry.
We're all dog owners.
No, fuck. I had it going. Sorry, I'm a little off today. But anyway.
Well, let's move on. So you mentioned how being part of the Players Association and business acumen that you learned from that, from there, from playing that, you moved into broadcasting. And tell us a little bit about broadcasting and then what you're doing now.
So, yeah, when I got done playing, I began job searching, thinking, and first off, I went into my last season of pro hockey knowing it was going to be my last year. It was intentional. I wanted my youngest daughter, who was turning 3 that year, to remember me as a hockey player. Maybe that's self-serving. I don't know.
No, I wish I had my kids that could remember that for me.
I mean, I remembered my dad racing cars, and that's just the coolest thing in the world, So I really wanted her to have that memory. I also felt like I had a bit of gas in the tank. I'm like, let's get one more year out of this. And it was a wild year, man.
I ended up playing
35, turning 36. Okay. And it was the timing was right. Like, I was still performing at a pretty high level. Like, we almost won the Calder Cup in the American League 2 years in a row, went to the finals, lost in game 7. Like, I was still performing. But I didn't want to be the guy that was like told, you're done, or you can't get a contract, or your body's failing. Body was still good. I felt like it was time to transition. I'd been thinking about it for a couple of years. And so I started job searching and thinking about what I would do afterwards. And I made a pact with myself that, okay, I'm going to retire. I'll probably take until like the new year. I'm going to take like 6 months off and just like do whatever. Maybe I coach some hockey, maybe just whatever. Well, that changed really quickly when I got an offer in the middle of summer to go be on TV for the Vegas Golden Knights and do pre-post intermission for them, to do color for the American Hockey League team on TV broadcast, to do kind of jack of all trades stuff for them. And I went, man, I'd love to do this, but I don't want to move to Vegas. I don't want to take my kids out there. I love it here. This is where I wanted to be. We're building a house. And they came back and, what can we do? We really want you. What can we do? And so I ended up taking a package with them. It was 2/3 of the games. And then the next year I did 3/4 of the games, an expanded role. And then COVID hit and just all up.
So were you traveling to Vegas?
I was going for 2 or 3 weeks at a time.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I'd go and I'd bunker in for a while.
Yeah.
Be away from my family the whole time. And it's like, man, I retired to not be away from my family, but this was such a good option. And And honestly, in the back of my head, the whole time I was thinking, I need to go and get experience so that I can either do this on a national scale or come home to St. Louis and maybe have a chance. That was my thought process. And so did it for 2 years. COVID hits. They downsize. I don't have a job with them anymore. Seattle offers me a job. I'm not moving to Seattle.
And wow.
I actually like Seattle, but I also don't like that my house would have cost four times as much as right. it does in St. Louis.
And it rains all the time.
I couldn't afford to do it. And I didn't want to move. Same thing. And so turned that one down, took a job and doing basically media, everything. I was writing extensively. Like I was writing, I don't even know how many words a week, like 10 pieces a week. dailyfaceoff.com, which is a hockey startup website, doing a live show four times a week and hosting SiriusXM, NHL Network on radio. And but all those things I just mentioned was like barely eking out a living.
And now, did you have experience writing before? There was this...
I went to school.
I mean, you went to school. I mean, obviously, I know. But I mean, like, were you doing journalism or anything?
No, like, I had no desire to do journalism because I thought it was a dead-end path. And then all of a sudden, here I am paid to write. And I actually did write during my playing career. I wrote for a publication called Ingle Magazine a lot. And it was kind of like my way to, you know, put to words my own experience on the ice. It was kind of cathartic in some ways to just, like, teach a little bit, you know, because I really...
Like your daily blog or, like...
A little bit, yeah. I mean, like, I had this knowledge of what we could do, and I was pretty good at articulating it, and I liked getting that out to people. I liked sharing. I liked teaching the sport. And even today, coaching kids, like, I just love teaching the sport. So that was my way to do it. Well, I did have to learn a different style of writing. You know, you write essay or you write papers in school, and your paragraphs are this long, right?
Well,
you write media, and your paragraphs can be one sentence sometimes. So as soon as I learned that, it was fine. But, yeah, I did that. I ended up on TNT between the benches in a playoff game between LA and the Oilers. That was the last time I was ever on TV. And it was like the pinnacle, right? Like I'm watching McDavid and Draisaitl go back and forth, and I'm calling it, and it was just amazing.
Do you miss it?
Yeah, I miss the rush of doing live TV. Live TV is awesome. Live TV is a lot more fun, too, if you're working with good people and people you enjoy. And
you did some stuff for the Blues.
Last year, yeah. And, man, last year I did like, I guess I did about a half dozen games on radio for them. And then between periods, I did some stuff on the Jumbotron, some analysis things. And like working with Chris Kerber was so much fun.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like, I mean like so fun, right? It's kind of a bucket list thing, you know, like I always wanted to work and do Blues games.
Sure.
And here I am getting that opportunity. So, and I have no idea where it's going to go. If I get to do more or not, I'm focused on something else now. We'll talk about that in a second, but I get to I doing that. Oh man, like it's really cool, and it does work for business too. People still kind of know who I am, which is, you know, it feels so egotistical to say that, but
it's brand recognition,
dude. You know,
that's a lot of what we talk about is brand recognition.
Think about our city. Hmm? Think about the characters in the city that have built amazing brands. Ted Drews, it really is good, guys. Turning it upside down. The carpet gal, was it Wendy the carpet gal? Yeah. You know, my favorite one now being in the liquor industry with Macadoodles, Dardenne Prairie, fine wine, beer, and spirits, opening in late October. But my favorite one was Fred Teutenberg from Dirt Cheap.
Cheap, fun.
And Fred Teutenberg was the guy who'd go on every commercial and go, it's the last place, the last home of the persecuted smoker. And he would host Freak of the Week on the Riz Show in the mornings.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember.
And, but his entire brand, and I mean this with the utmost respect and love for what I'm going to say, because I've been to more dirt tracks than you could ever imagine. That guy's brand was being the biggest Hoosier in St. Louis.
Yeah.
And he killed with it. Yeah. Killed. He owned his brand to the core. It's who he was. And that's just stuck with me. Where like, if people come in this liquor store that we're doing where I'm managing the place and they at least now they've got a face. Oh, it's Mike. He was on the Jumbotron at the Blues game. Or, you know, I've seen him on our social media. You instantly feel a connection to the people you're working with. Guys, for you on social, like they come in, I'm sure they come in for you guys, what you're doing in the real world. And it's, there's Pat. Oh, I feel like I know him.
Right.
I feel like I know Zach.
Right.
I trust them. People trust you. That's where you win.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, that's why social media is so powerful. I mean, you can get a snapshot into kind of who someone is before you even meet them. You know, it's one of the first things I do before, like before you came, last night I'm scrolling through all your social media. Yep. I'm just like, all right, I want to get a, idea who Mike is before I meet him. You know, I know you guys know each other, and but I was like, I've never met you before, and well, I want to get a kind of an idea of who you are. And you know, I'm scrolling through, looking at all the stuff, watching the, you know, all the updates with the new store, like everything. I'm like, okay, cool. I've got an idea of what to expect here. And you just kind of go in with an expectation, and it totally gives you a picture of who someone is. Obviously you learn more when you actually meet someone in person, but you know, just something so powerful that we have today that we didn't have 10 years ago. Mm-hmm.
And you go to hire somebody.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That's the first thing you're looking at.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Pull up the Facebook, pull up the Instagram, let's see what they're all about.
We're all creating, you know, we're not creeping anymore. We're doing homework.
100%. Like, you're putting it out there. You know, it is what it is.
Yeah. It's such a good, and I always told this, like, I'll give you a great example. I got a buddy of mine who, I won't mention his name, but the guy was in a relationship for like 8 years. Okay. And breaks up, she moves out, and he went back into the dating pool, and he was having a hard time. Now, he's an eccentric dude.
Dating just sucks, first off.
I'm glad I don't have to do that
single
anymore.
Single dad here. It's rough out there.
The same chick for 14 years, so I'm very remiss.
I'm pushing 20. Yeah. I know more than 20. But so my buddy was just kind of lost on it. And I'm like, dude, you're looking in the wrong spots. You're just doing dating apps and that's it. I go, and you have no social media footprint. And like, you've got to get something out. You're a fun guy, man. At the very least, I'm telling you, just make an Instagram and show who you are, right? He puts it up and he's got a picture of him with like his face is like half covered or something. Like, you look like a serial killer, man. Like, knock it off, dude. Like, you have things to offer these women, you know? And, it's kind of just a microcosm though, where I just felt like my friend could really represent who he was and kind of I'm like, you don't even have to make it public, man. They can request you. If you just tell them what it is, they can request you. It doesn't have to be public. You know, this is your tool to show who you are. Some people fake it. That's fine. You'll find that out quick.
Yeah.
But man, I think most people on there are pretty genuine. What you see is what you get, especially if it's a private one. What do you have to hide on that? You know?
Right, exactly.
Well, and that's the thing is you can only be so fake for so long before like the real version of you comes out. I mean, obviously you can see it with influencers. They're only posting the highlights of their lives. But I mean, if you really want to have success on social media, you have to be vulnerable. You have to be real. And I think the ones that are doing that, you know, are having the most success.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, I mean, that's where I'm at on mine. I mean, I get to see all things. And like, that's what I love about this podcast is it's hard to fake who we are. I mean, what are we, 80 something episodes in now?
I think this is episode 80.
Yeah. So, you know, it's hard to fake who you are for 80 episodes and be, you know, I can't carry that shit on.
1 to 2 hour conversations with, you know, with either just him and I or with a guest. It's can't hide who you are for that many hours.
The fun part's what you discover about one another and even about yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, there's times where I've looked at my social media or I've looked at even Twitter posts and I went, Mike, you got to dial it back. You're being a dick.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm serious. We're like, and especially when I was in media, I just kind of started to realize sometimes like this negative vortex takes over you, where if you're writing all the time and you're trying to get you are literally trying to get clicks. That's your job, is to get clicks. And it's like, I learned real fast that I could do an analysis piece that I'm so proud of. I cut video and write it and it takes me 8 hours and it gets 700 clicks. If I write a hit piece on why one player's a poor teammate for doing something on the ice in a big city like Vancouver or something, 30,000 clicks, you know, and then that's what's expected. So you also learn through media and being in media why media is the way it is. People consume media when they want to be outraged, and they are not when they want to. They want justification for their outrage, and it just turns into like this negative cycle. And I kind of felt like I got caught up in that, where I was just like,
well, it's easy to.
I was like upset all the time. I'm like, and publicly, I'm like, oh, you got to stop this, dude. Like, you don't want people to get the wrong impression here. Like, it's got to self-evaluate sometimes.
Well, that's why we started this. I mean, you know, when we sat down and we're like, well, what direction do we want to go with this? And we're like, you know, we hear so much, like, there's so much negative out there. We want to put a positive spin on these things. Like, you know, manhood and fatherhood and like the importance of those things and putting positive spins on those things and entrepreneurship. Obviously entrepreneurship is hard, and you know, it's something that can be negative if you're not in the right headspace, but we try to put positive spins on all of these things. And you know, hopefully it resonates with people, because you know, we're not sitting here trying to just get clickbait and or put out clickbait just to get people to tune into us. We want to present value. And yeah, I mean, it's just, it's so far, I think we've been pretty good at it.
It's kind of a delicate dance. Like you mentioned, the negative stuff or the controversial stuff is the stuff that's going to get all the clicks. And I mean, I think that's very true. I mean, we talk about that with our producer Murph a lot. You know, he does a lot of like political commentary, mm-hmm. and obviously his stuff, you know, he'll say some things sometimes and that shit pops off. And it's just, you know, I feel like you got to kind of figure out what you want to do as far as like, you want to be that controversial, and then you're going to be kind of surrounded by that shit all the time. And I think that, I don't think that's good for us.
Well, either, if you're going to lean into it, you really have to.
You have to. You got to kind of go all in on it.
Yeah, and I'll give you a good example now, like doing our marketing for our show, or marketing for our store. Mm. We sell to everybody, right? Like your demographics are everybody.
Yeah.
And I've always taken pride in that I truly judge my friends on how I enjoy interacting with them, not by their alliances to things. Now there's limits.
Sure.
I mean, if somebody's out there murdering cats, we're not going to be friends. You know what I mean? But like, even now though, with what we're doing. Yeah. So, I mean, like when you're putting together a marketing plan, you're trying to hit every demographic that's going to be in your store. Well, bourbon, huge for a liquor store right now. It's just taken off in a meteoric rise. It's leveled off. It's not declining. So it's still a huge part, right? And it's just kind of hit its peak. But
why is that?
Well, it just had become so saturated with barrel picks and new things and allocateds and people spending secondary pricing. I think
you can only do so much with bourbon.
You can. And now you're at a point where collectors have kind of filled their cabinets and digging. Like they're doing different cask finishes, and they're just digging for anything different at this point. Quality's still out there. I just think it's kind of it's starting to stabilize a little. Tequila's the one though that's going like skyrocketing because they're doing all the same shit that they did to bourbon out of tequila. Okay. So, but anyway, like what, you know, we're searching for people to work with. Well, I mean, there's somebody that is a very prominent scene in conservative talk radio. And for me, it's like, yeah, this is a person that we need to be working with, and person who's really into bourbon, you know, and you have to target who is going to help you and work together. And that's the real world, right? Like whether people's align how they are. We're going to people working in our store that are all over the place. Liberal, conservative, you name it, man. That's the real world. You can't work together, you're not going to be successful. Right. And so, you know, for me, I've been happy about it I think that the background I've had with that is that I just don't toss people out the window if I don't disagree with them. You know, and I know some
people.
Problem
with society that most people do.
I know some people that just have straight up purity tests, you know, and it's like, I just can't handle that. And like, I don't want to throw out half of this world.
Right.
When
they think a different way.
And honestly, I don't think I really align
either way.
Anyway, you know, you know what I mean? So why do that? I don't want to be tribalistic.
90% of people I feel like are in the middle, you know,
I think so.
I mean, maybe not 90%, but some majority percentage. I feel like
it's over 50% are pretty similar.
Like I wouldn't say I'm on one side or the other, but I mean, I'm somewhere in the middle for sure.
But I just think you do really have to be careful in media that if you're willing to put out your political feelings, man, you're going to face backlash. End of story. And people aren't going to like it. And it's dangerous waters.
Especially if you don't know what you're talking about and just trying to wing it. Like, you really need to be on top of your shit. And that's part of the reason why, one, I don't want to dive into it because, like, I know enough political stuff that'll affect my job and what I do. Not enough to sit here and try and debate somebody on being a Democrat versus Republican. But they're talking points are like that's not my thing.
It's media is as powerful as you want to make it. If you're gonna go for that, man, you better be ready to go for it hard,
and you better expect some backlash.
You better have the thickest skin. My biggest thing is I worry about real longevity. Like even if you think you want to do it and you want to do it for a while, you're forever going to be branded as whatever has gone wrong or that way, you know. So we always talked about being true to ourselves, but there is kind of have to curate what you show, just knowing that you still have to, if you want to play in all sandboxes.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing.
Make sure you stay in those lanes.
And there's someone that we follow and that, you know, we do, you know, we support their products and all that, but he recently just came out and he fucked up big time. And, you know, he's done a lot of good for the society and communities that he's working in, but at the same time, like, yeah, he made a fucked up comment, and now that's hurting his company over, even though he's 15, 20 years worth of positive shit, like, now
millions of dollars donated and all these things, and now people are dropping them left and right.
Yeah.
Well, and companies, though, can prove to be resilient. That's the thing. And
I don't think they're going anywhere.
I don't think they'll.
No, I don't think so. But even for me, like, I mean, I kind of had my own axis of evil, people I didn't want to support, you know? But here's the thing. I didn't support them. Whether I'm being petty. Yeah, I'm probably being a little petty, right? Like, Jimmy John, I don't think Jimmy John's a very good person, okay? I don't go to Jimmy John's. Yeah. I like Jersey Mike's more. That's my personal decision. I don't like taking that decision and telling somebody that you shouldn't support that.
Right.
That's their choice. Now, I can tell them why I don't. Like, I don't support just killing animals for the fun of it. I just don't. That's my choice. I don't support that. But I don't like things being put on somebody like that. Like, and honestly, if you like somebody's products, there's a disassociation, because if you're going to purity test this like crazy, I guarantee there's companies out there that I support an awful lot that have some people involved at high places that I may not agree with in any way. It just may not be as public. So it's really kind of a fine line there to just throw the baby out with the bathwater on everything for one person sometimes. But that's why we're free to make a choice, man. Right. Purchasing power. If you don't want to support them, don't support them.
Yeah, vote with absolutely your dollar.
That's it. Know? It's powerful. Yeah. So,
well, tell us about Macadoodles.
Macadoodles is, I tell you what, man, this place.
Well, actually, first of all, I want to know how did that transition from hockey to Macadoodles?
Like, that, well, that's
or,
actually.
I guess it was hockey media, then Macadoodles?
Yeah.
Or somewhere in that?
It was it. So, and that's actually a great topic for even this, is that what I learned is networking.
Oh, it's
everything. Is huge. I got to tell you, man, I didn't realize how big of a net I cast. Like, my network was huge from hockey and just maintaining relationships over the years. A little text here or there that just when you notice somebody, like, oh man, great job on this. You know, that's kind of what led to my deal with Macadoodles. Well, there's a guy in town, his name's Tom Kyman. He runs Mia Rose Holdings. They do developments all throughout St. Louis and the Midwest. And, a fellow hockey guy, played at Michigan Tech. My first NCAA game was against him. And I didn't know him, only from on the ice. And he put together the Maryville Arena out in Chesterfield Valley. And
it's beautiful.
And it's gorgeous. You know, it's a public-private partnership. That's really hard to pull off, like really hard. And I never used LinkedIn like years ago while I was playing. But when he got it done, I had found him on there. I just sent him a message. Man, amazing job. Like, this is a huge thing for our city. Just thank you. And that was kind of it. 4 or 5 years later, when I needed advice on what to do, and I just asked Tom, like, hey, can I sit with you for a little while? And I truly just wanted his advice on where he thought my skill set would itself best. Yeah, okay, no problem. And he doesn't take everybody. He's a busy dude. And like a week later, he's like, you ever heard of Macadoodles? and I'd talked to people, a lot of people in town that were powerful, wealthy, like successful, you know, and I had more options than I thought. And that's great. And it just kind of reminded me, like, my friends that went to school but they weren't in any clubs, they didn't do any, they weren't a frat, they just went to school. And some of them have struggled a little bit. It's like, you network. You like, you literally don't know anybody. And I love you. You're my closest friends, but we could see this coming. And so I said, I think he's like, you ever heard of Macadoodles? No. Well, it's a liquor store. I'm like, okay. I mean, I drink casually, but I don't love it. Pat, you know more about bourbon than I do, probably. You know, like, I know more about wine than you do, probably. Right. But it's, I was intrigued by it. And then, so I went, okay, well, yeah. So I went for a drive. And I just drove to Columbia, Osage Beach, Jeff City. And I visited three of these on my own. I did my own homework on it. And I drove out of Lake of the Ozarks place, and I texted Tom, like, let's fucking do this. And I was like, so excited, man, because this liquor store doesn't feel like a liquor store. It doesn't feel transactional. It doesn't feel like a big box. It doesn't feel like you're walking into a porn shop. Like, you walk in and it's like exposed wood beams and a gorgeous wine room.
Feels like you're walking into like a Bass Pro or something.
Dude, the best way to describe this, if Bass Pro Shops, Cracker Barrel, and Ace Hardware had like a bastard threesome. Yeah. Like, that's kind of what a Macadoodles is. That's a liquor store, you know?
Yeah.
And it is. Like, it's very rural. It's very Ozarkian. And I mean, anybody that goes outside in Missouri, you know what I mean? Hardwoods, trails, like Momo the Monster, you know? You know what I mean? Like Bigfoot. I just it felt different. There's tastings going on. You walk into the wine room. Hey, you want to try something? You know, like it just had such a different feel. He's like, yeah, well, I talked to Tom. He's like, we need somebody that can head up this project for us. And with eyes of potentially doing and multifamily housing, you want to get one of those done. They really like having a retail component to go with it. Cities do. Municipalities do. Why? They don't want their residents to have to pay property taxes through the roof. That's what happens if you don't have retail, right? You got to pay for this stuff. So, yeah, I sat there and was like, we need somebody to head it up, somebody to manage it. There's that maybe an equity stake involved. And that really is what turned the corner for me. It was like, man, I don't know if I want to like just think manage a liquor store the rest of my life here. Although I think this is a good job opportunity. If I have an equity stake in this, I own it. My ass is in. This is my baby. This is, and managing it then becomes really exciting because I get to control my own destiny and hopefully grow it into something that we can have people in multiple locations and hire from within and build and do. And so it got my brain going and it made me excited. My wife looked at me at one point, she goes, why are you considering these other things? And that was before I'd taken that trip. You know, like, I think they're good options, you know, and she found, you're so excited about this. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And so that's kind of how it came about. And now I came on board in November full time. I had my contract to finish up. Yeah, I had my contract to finish up in 2023 with SiriusXM on the radio and also doing daily face-off stuff. Took a month and dove head first on this. And I mean, I've done everything from procure everything in the building, basically done the development of the building. Worked with everyone from the architects to the shelving companies to millwork companies and learned what cut sheets were and learned what shop drawings. And now I've gone through hiring. And next step now is to go to training, which I've done some of previously. Then I get to manage this place. I didn't know any of this. I still don't know any.
Just learning on the fly, yeah, though. That's the best way to do it, you know?
What has been like the biggest challenge so far for you?
You know, I don't know if it's been a challenge, but it's been new to me, and it's really learning how to let other people take on roles and do things. Again, being an only child, and I'd always just done everything myself.
Yeah.
And there are things that we have people in our group that are better at other things. And I've always felt like I was burdened, and I'm not. It's their job. It's what they do best, right? You got a guy that does POS systems and stuff, and he's just a genius with it. Give it to him. He wants it. Let him have it. You know, once we start hiring here, hey, beer department, this is yours. So purposefully hiring people that fit the puzzle, because I need to be able to trust them to do what they do and not have to have them. I should just be orchestrating this thing. So it's really that trust level. I knew how to negotiate. That part was easy. You know, I knew how to make phone calls and procure things and stuff. That was simple enough. But really managing day to day is going to be the biggest challenge. Payroll, hiring, firing, inventory,
yeah,
all that stuff.
It's awesome.
And I don't know shit right now. So please come support us. But I mean, you do learn. You learn quickly. You go and train, and you figure it out, man. My favorite three words: figure it out.
Right? Figure it out.
Some people don't like when I say figure it out.
Yeah. But that's the thing, though. Like being an entrepreneur, I mean, you just got to jump in. Like, you can't just sit back and hope something's going to happen. You got to get in there and. And you're going to fail at things, yep. And you have to look at those failures, not so much as a failure, but a learning experience and be able to move on from that and be better moving forward.
Yeah. And Pat, I think the big thing for entrepreneurship and taking ownership of what you're doing is you can just jump in all by yourself if you want.
Oh, but
and some people succeed and do it. Some people do, but the rate that don't,
this guy,
there's a lot that don't. And I think some of my biggest advice would be if you're going to do something where you do have a big ownership stake in it, want to, is make sure you've got support structure that you can at minimum on people that know what they're doing. My business partners have franchising experience as well as anybody in town.
Yeah.
Development experience I'd put up against anybody. Successful. They know how to do that. They trusted me to take this on. Wow. Why? You know, so it's a give and take. There's confidence there. But it's got to be calculated. Entrepreneurship has to be calculated in my eyes when you get to an older state, at least.
Sure.
You're 25, man. you can do what you please. You know what I mean? Like, you can absolutely toss all your money at it. If you're older like myself and you're going to go into something that's a bit of a great unknown, it's got to be really calculated. You've got to know your limits. You've got to know your risk limits, especially.
Especially because you have your family. You've got your wife and girls. So,
I mean, I could have dumped everything I had into this. And I dumped a good amount, but not everything. Like, if this goes sour, it's going to hurt.
Yeah.
Bad. But I'd get an amazing education out of it.
Sure.
And I'd still be able to live. So, calculated risks.
That's awesome. Well, that's awesome. I'm excited for you. I know being neighbors, I've kind of been there for the journey, living right next to you and hearing about all that stuff. So it's awesome. I'm excited for you. When do you guys open?
It's going to be at the last half of October. If everything goes amazing, third week of October.
Getting there.
Probably the fourth week of October. But our grand opening is going to be 2 weeks long at least and probably go right through the holidays. And we're planning some big stuff. I don't want to say everything here because something may fall through, but it'll be cool. We're a big enough store, just under 10,000 square feet, that we already have the respect of the vendors here and they get a big success. And
it helps that, I mean, McAdoodles is a big name. Mm-hmm. I mean, that helps Karen carry some weight. So
yeah, it's funny because I've had a lot of people ask me, are you starting a restaurant? You know, and because it's not descript. It's not I mean, you know what Total Wine's selling.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. McAdoodles could be a restaurant. It could be a, I don't know, bar. It could be
an Irish dance studio.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know. So I truly believe this, and this is what's happened in other locations. It's a branding problem at first that turns into a branding asset once people know who you are and what you do.
Yeah.
Because it's happened in every other city. It'll happen here. And there are a lot of people. If you go to the lake, if you go to Brant's, anywhere else, they do see these. Columbia.
That's where I know it from. I didn't go to Mizzou, but I went and visited my buddies multiple times, and they live right up the street. I don't know which location. Is there multiple?
There's one in Columbia.
Okay, yeah. So then I've been to that one several times.
Thank you.
Of course.
And that's a great location. Like, that store knocks down a good figure every year, solid as could be, consistent.
College, man.
I think that also leads to the possibility of great success. Is like, there's no other one here, so people don't know what it is, and it allows you to open their eyes to what it actually is and build that story and build that for them so they can experience for themselves for the first time.
We want them to have a great experience in our store. We want them to have a great experience in Osage Beach. That's not our ownership group. There's one going into Union, Missouri. That's not our ownership group. I tell you what, though, I want that Union store to kick ass, man, because I want people to have a great experience there, take it back to our place, work as a team like that. That's important to me. So. It is. If we can get this area, I just keep thinking, you know, like if we actually get big enough, we could be on the boards of the game or something. How cool would that be?
That would be cool.
You know, dude, that'd be so cool.
Yeah, it'd be fun. And I think this market's kind of hungry for something like that. You know, there's not really a big bridge between a grocery store and some of the box. I mean, something a little more personalized. And I hope we can fill that void.
That's awesome. Well, I'm excited for you. I'm excited to see it. So anything else you want to talk about before we let you go?
I don't have anything more to sell.
Okay.
I really mean it, though, that this store is my baby. It is something I'd love to see people come into the store and just say hi.
Yeah.
We're proud of the place, so we're happy to show people what we've done. And I'm thankful you guys having me on and tell my story.
Absolutely.
Here. It's fun to dive into something just other than pure sports.
Right, for sure.
And you can tell even my perspective and you as well. You're both sitting here. We've always thought about things outside of sport.
No, of course.
Of course.
And,
well, and that's the thing. I mean, you only play a sport for so long. And that's like one of the biggest things, because I've seen people come out of baseball and really struggle. And it's great to see, like, I love the success stories of people that had success in sports and then they've continued that success on afterwards, because that's like, I want to see everybody do that. You know, it kills me when I see some of these posts and some of these groups that I'm a part of, professional athletes that are just like, hey, I'm really struggling right now ever since getting out of sport. I don't know what to do with my life and things like that. And it's like, it breaks my heart. But you know, it's awesome to see. It's just so cool to see people that have been very successful at the highest level and then they just don't lose that. They keep pushing forward in other aspects of life. And that's awesome. And I'm happy for you. And I look forward to watching you continue to succeed at this. So,
I appreciate it. Yeah.
I think great meeting you. Yeah.
That one takeaway, never lose your competitiveness.
Oh, no. Yeah. No, you can't.
Just find something that you can be competitive in And if you're an ex-athlete or anything else, I don't care if it's landscaping or anything. If you're competitive and you want to kick the opponent's ass or kick the competition's ass.
That's why I love this job.
You'd be the best damn landscaper there is.
I always said that. I'm like, even if I lost everything, I'd be the best goddamn sandwich maker Subway has.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, that's just how we're wired. Like, yeah,
people think I'm crazy because I've said this before. And like, I feel like no matter what avenue or where I would have gone because of that competitiveness, that I would have been the best at what I did. Because like, that's what our drive is. Our drive as athletes is to be the best at what we do. Or
gotta believe.
Everything that we do, we're putting our all into it. Yep. So,
gotta believe, man.
Well, we like to end the show with one last question, kind of catch guys by surprise. It's called the Tombstone Game. Here lies Mike. What's it say on your tombstone?
Here lies Mike. He knew a little bit about a lot of things.
I love it. That's good.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, Mike, it was great having you on here. Great hearing about all the things that you've been through in life, through sports, and now after sports, and the success that you're having carrying on afterwards. So.
All right, man. Well, thank you, everybody, for tuning into the show. Make sure to hit that like button below. Subscribe to the show if you're not subscribed, and we will see you next time.